Shalom. We're finding our seats, getting really close and cozy with our neighbors.
There's another spot right here.
Beautiful. Helping each other pass through the crowd. So as we're settling, we're going to keep our voices low to whisper, because I would like to take the time, and I feel incredibly honored to be able to introduce this man. John Young is a personal teacher of mine for the past 9 years, and of anybody in this world besides, I'd say, my mother, this person has facilitated positive change in my life. And a little bit about him. He's a world-famous tracker and author, one of the greatest cultural changers of our times, and founder of the Eat Shields and Nature Connection movement, if any of you have heard those words or are familiar with that or part of those movements. He's labored, though often joyously, if you're going to be around him, often with really good music, for the last 30 years to bring indigenous wisdom from intact cultures, initiated elders, and cultural technologies that aid the regenerative process for our culture. Not to mention the fact that he's started schools and programs throughout North America and Europe for generating deeper nature connection. And now there's building programs in places like South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Israel. There's interest in Israel in places like Central America. So hopefully the movement just continues to grow. So thank you for being here. Thank you for taking the time from your family, from your travels, whatever it took to get you here. We welcome you.
Thank you, Rachel, for introducing our teacher, John. And today we are going to mine John's heart and mind a little bit and hear some of his fantastic stories and wisdom teachings. And Rachel and I will be in conversation with him, asking him some questions that connect what we're doing here to what he's been thinking about and creating over the last 30-plus years. And so I just want to dive right in. And I'm really honored, too, to have Rabbi Bert and Rabbi Dan up front in this community. And I just start with asking these questions. I'm looking at Rabbi Bert because Reb Bert's been studying the Baal Shem Tov for a really long time. And he just gave I heard some wonderful teachings in the greenhouse connected to him. And my first question for you, John, has to do with looking backwards at some of the masters, including the Baal Shem Tov, the great master who was born around 1700, who is known as the great nature mystic, known for his powers to speak with animals and trees and birds and to create healing in the woods for many people. And that's 300 years ago, plus. And if we go into our ancient script, we go into the Talmud itself, the conversation of the rabbis that dates back 300, 500 years after the birth of Christ, after that time, after the Common Era, we understand of some of our great masters from way back, from 2,000 years ago, like Rabbi Hillel the Elder, for example. He's the great master who said, "Do not do unto others as you would not do unto yourself." That's his commentary, right? He's the great rabbi, one of the greatest of the greats. And the Talmud says that he also spoke to trees and to birds and to stones and had these similar powers that the Baal Shem Tov had. So I want to ask you, John, about why is it that in this day and age we have these stories about these people, but I'm not sure how many of us still have access to that. I know from your work in Nature Connection you've thought a lot about this and you've actually helped a lot of people reconnect in these ways. So I just want to start with you know, that question.
Start with a really easy one. First, thanks everybody for stepping in here like so many sardines. Really nice. You're welcoming me to my own neighborhood, which is great, because I it's not a big deal for me to drive down the hill to this place, which is that little barn down on Highway 1. I'll be playing my fiddle tonight for the barn dance, which I live for that. You know, it's just the weekend I don't go anywhere. So In future, let's make sure we always plan our events around the barn dance at Pi Ranch. Yeah, that's a huge question, but it's also, you know, it is basically my life's work is to try and figure out why some people can talk to trees and birds and stones and others can't. And I've looked all over the world for the people who can, from every tradition that I could possibly get my eyes and brains around. I've gotten to know several of those people personally. I was mentored and initiated by several of them. So I allow myself to be a human guinea pig for these things so that I could try to understand them, you know, as a living laboratory of human biology. Because I think, you know, that kind of ability is more common than we know. It's something that we're all capable of in this barn. And we all have stories from our lives, these moments where we knew we had these moments of communication that were hard to explain within the framework of common mechanistic thinking. So I think what's happening right now, there's a new science being ushered in as we're alive. Right now we're alive during the time when the likes of Rupert Sheldrake are going from the people who get stoned in the courtyard for being heretics, scientific heretics, to people who are now being called the new Einsteins. He literally was even, someone tried to assassinate him, you know, publicly. And Rupert Sheldrake I'm happy to call him friend. He's an amazing man. And he's one of the people who is actually beginning to develop the scientific modeling, framing the scientific modeling that helps explain why we're all capable of this stuff. And also the sort of geopolitical, social understanding of why we're not doing that. You know, because the reason we're not doing it isn't because we're not biologically capable or designed to do it. It's because we're not sociologically accepted to progress on the journey of nature connection to that level. So every year for the last 4 years, I've gone to the Kalahari to be with some of the last trance healers in Botswana. And these are people who have all the gifts that were just described. You know, they can talk to birds, they can talk to stones, they can talk to animals. And they're capable of this healing ability, which you can read about in Bradford Keeney's documentation of that, Bushman Healers is what it's called, by Ringing Rock Press. And, you know, Keeney spent, I don't know, 10 years wandering around the Kalahari before that period was put to a kind of a violent end. You know, the San Bushmen have been extremely oppressed by all the cultures around that region, and they have been essentially, you know, more or less genocidally eliminated down to a very tiny remnant of their once numbers, which was, by the way, pretty much all of Africa. But they're not, you know, when you look at Africa, you don't think of the Bushmen, but they're the original inhabitants, and they've been there for 135,000 years. Just sit with that number for a second, you know. Those people have been in their place for 135,000 years, and they've never left it. And there's one thing that happens when indigenous people are moved off their land, and I know certainly all of you can relate to this story. When people are dispossessed, you know, taken off their land, a lot of trauma results from that. And that trauma also affects people's ability to regenerate their culture, you know. So in regions of Botswana where the Bushmen have been dispossessed so that national parks can be made, for instance, you know, they're taken off the park and they're put into these settlements. The alcoholism rate is extreme, you know, the depression rate, the violent rate. The Bushmen are nonviolent people, but all of a sudden all this negativity emerges from them. The ones that haven't been dispossessed are still in control of a lot of really interesting cultural phenomena, and the ones that I visit in western Botswana are not dispossessed. You know, they're people who have hidden away and kept a low profile and managed to stay in their original land because of it. So they've cooperated with the local farmers. One particular family that's been there for six generations has kept them safe. There was a period of time when you could buy a hunting license to hunt for a Bushman. And that only ended in 1955. So it wasn't that long ago, you know, you could hunt an eland and you could hunt a Bushman, and the women were worth different prices than the men. And it was really a hard thing for these people to survive through, but survive they did. And there's a small number of them, but they're very beautiful, open people. And I've gone to them because I want to understand, you know, they seem to be still in touch with the ability to communicate with the trees and the animals and the stones, and they have ceremonies to bring in the rains, and they still bring in the rains, because in the Kalahari, there's no rivers flowing, you know? Does that sound familiar? And so they have a powerful tradition around bringing rain, and there was a man there, his name is Hanuma. He's an elder bushman. He's probably nearly 80 or just right around there. And he's a trance healer. He's also a rain caller. And I got to see both of these things in action for the last 4 years. And I watched him one night call in the rain. And he called in the rain for us so that we would see, that we would know it was him, that the lightning and the thunder would take the form of a snake moving through the sky. That it wouldn't, there'd be no mistaking it. Like, you know, it wouldn't be like a random rainstorm in the Kalahari. You would actually see the lightning going across the sky in the form of a snake moving through the sand. And the sound of the lightning was something along the lines of shh. And then the thunder happened again and again. And we just stood there with our hair standing up. It was like 4 a.m. You know, it just woke us up because everyone was just awakened by this phenomenon that was obviously occurring. And we asked him, you know, about the lightning shaped like snakes and the sound that was moving through the night of a snake moving through the sand. And he said, oh, yeah, that was me. I was doing that for you guys so you would see that we still know these things. And they're very low-key about all this. They just take it for granted. In fact, they wonder why we can't do it, actually. And there's a lot in that story, and I'm starting right there because I just want you to look at these people as people who have never been troubled by modern existence, right? They don't have bills to pay. They don't have, you know, issues of wondering how they're going to keep their mortgage going, and they don't have jobs, and they don't have to go anywhere. They don't know what Monday is, you know? One time, one of them looked at me because I was looking at my watch, really sort of, you know how you look at your watch so much, then you just look at it, and you don't even know you're looking at it. But I looked at this carabiner watch that was hanging from my belt loop, and I looked down at it for a second, and the old guy looked at me, and he pointed, and he said something in Bushman, and the translator said, he wants to know if that's a timepiece. And I felt so busted, you know. And I said, yes, that's a timepiece. He says, I don't like these things, through the translator. And I said, well, why? He said, because every time someone looks at one of those, the very next thing they do is usually rude. Right? Just let that settle on you for a second, you know? Like, what does he mean by rude, you know? And to me, the word rude really could translate, if you really try to understand it culturally from his perspective, he's basically saying disconnected. Disconnected, you know? Whatever's going on that I'm essentially imposing some artificial understanding of the universe on you because I bought into it. You haven't, but I'm going to impose it on you anyway, right? And he doesn't really see the world that way. You know, their measurement of whether or not they're on the right track is how much love is present. You know, they're looking for love, and they're feeling love, they're looking for it, they're very loving, so when you're with them, you feel this amazing morphic resonance of love when you're with 20, 30 of these people and you're just out hunting and gathering with them. And the children are all really incredible and super open, and it's a really awesome experience to be with them. And so I just look at, you know, another story that I'm going to bring to you from a man who came over from another part of the world, and he was... he runs a big industrial supply company in Europe, and his father passed away and left it to him. And he didn't really want to be the CEO of a company like that, but he ended up doing it. And secretly, he loves healing. And he has to kind of hide that from his family because his family puts him down for that. But he's been a logistical support for me when I'm traveling in Europe for about 8 years. And he'll pick me up from the airport and bring me back, and then after teaching, he'll always bring me to a really nice spa so I can relax and unwind. And so he's always been really good to me, and then when we're driving around, he's always asking me all these really intense questions about healing, and because he wants to understand sort of the original roots of healing, you know, because he has this gift that when he looks at a person, he says he can put on certain eyes and then he can see their energy field around their body. And when he sees their energy field, it's always showing up in the form of an egg around that person, three-dimensional egg, and he'll see black spots in it. So he'll go to the black spot, he'll reach through it and touch the body in that spot, and there'll always be pain right there. So he says he doesn't quite know what he's seeing, but he understands that where the black spots are is like a some kind of a, you know, energy block in the body. So he's been studying Lomi Lomi from the Hawaiians, and he's been studying all these different kinds of body work and Reiki and stuff, and he's trying to figure out, who am I in relationship to this gift that I possess? And in the meantime, I have this company to run, and I have to pretend that I don't have all these skills. But he sneaks out on weekends and goes to healing retreats, and he offers healings for friends and quietly, you know, helps people. He started asking me about the healer, the Bushman healer that I was telling you about down in the Kalahari. He asked me about him. He said, tell me about this man, you know, and I said, I explained to him, you know, what I've seen him do with the calling of the rain, but also in the healings that he's performed for people. And he said, do you think he's the real thing? I said, well, I'm not sure what you mean by the real thing, but he's a real thing. You know, he's there. He's a human being. He's alive, and he does these things. He says, well, I want to go see him. I said, well, come see him, you know. So it took him about 3 years finally to get up the nerve to come, but he did come. And he said to me, the reason he was coming and why he was so excited was because he wanted to see this man's egg. Right? So that's a really interesting perspective, you know. So he goes, he arrives, and we get, we stop in Mound Botswana in this little bed and breakfast place called Discovery, which has rendezvous with grass thatched roofs and down by the Tamalakani River, you know, so it's a good place to land and kind of get on the time zone and hang out for a day or two before we get on a bush plane and fly out to the central Kalahari. And usually somebody misses a plane somewhere and someone's luggage gets lost, so it's a good thing to wait there in that town for everyone to gather logistically and to get in the space of Africa. So we do that. Then we fly on these little bush planes out to this place where these bushmen live. And we get off this plane, and we arrive on the airstrip, little dirt airstrip. You have to fly over it once and then come around because you have to chase giraffes off of it if they're standing there, because you can't land with giraffes on the airstrip. It's dangerous. So we get back to the place where the Bushmen are going to meet us that night, and they've got a little fire going. And we drive there in the back of these pickup trucks across these dirt roads, and we find these people. And then this man who I'm talking about, he comes up to me with this really worried look on his face. I'm like, what's the matter? He says, something very strange is happening to me. I said, well, what's happening to you? He said, well, I don't know. He says, I can't find his egg. Right? I'm like, and he has this really funny look on his face. I'm like, what do you mean you can't find his egg? He says, well, every time, he says, I'll talk to you about it later tonight, but every time I try to find his egg, instead I fall inside of him. I said, huh. So later that night, he describes this phenomenon to me, right? He said he would use he'd put on his egg eyes, and he would look at the eggs of the people that were around, you know, and then he would look at Hanuma, and he would try to find his egg, but he couldn't find it. And then he would fall inside Hanuma in his consciousness, and he would suddenly find himself as the stars and the wind and the trees and the lizards and the sand. He was suddenly the whole Kalahari. And he thought, something strange is going on. I'm missing his egg. I must be jet-lagged, or I'm trying too hard or something. So he was kept backing out again and then looking again and then falling into him. And as he became conscious that this was really happening, he allowed it to happen. And he said it was the most profound spiritual experience of his entire life, where he was suddenly the entire Kalahari in that whole region. And he could see it all from this really elevated space, which he just felt was like God. He said, I just feel like I was like mixed into this field, which I could only say was the Creator. That was all I could feel. So, thank you. So, I'll just put it down here for a bit. I think, you know, we talked to Hanuma about that, and he just nodded. Yeah, he said, yeah. Right? So, you know, to me, why do I go to that guy? Not because, like, he has... I want to understand him in the context of what it is to be a human being who's really connected, you know, because ultimately that's what you're looking at there, a human being who is completely connected to their place. I mean, totally, utterly connected to their place. And the other thing I want to just say about this is that, you know, if you go to a good concert, and, you know, especially if it's like a jamming kind of band concert, and the band hits the groove, right? The dancing gets really alive, and there's like an electricity that's present. You know that feeling? So that is also a phenomenon that you should pay attention to, because the Bushman healer, he cannot heal people, and he can't call in the rain until the band hits the groove. And the band hits the groove, and you can really sense it, because I'm a musician, and I know when our band hits the groove, we play until we hit the groove, so our dancers can really feel that and get electrified, you know? Like, that's what we live for, that moment. And we know that that's healing for everybody in the room when that energy is really flowing and cycling, right? You know that too. And so we just sometimes think of that as fun. But I want you to know that there's an actual biological circuit going on there. You know, I'm going to call it human electricity. And that humans are designed, I'm pretty sure, that when we come together with common purpose and unity, and we know how to hit the groove, we can generate another field of electricity that some people are capable of channeling and doing wondrous things with. And Hanuma has told me straight up, I can't heal people unless the singers hit that place where it's really flowing, he said, you know. But when the singers get to that place, and it's all women singing, all these women are singing on the ground, and they're clapping with this really interesting polyrhythmic rhythm that I can't bring home. You know, I go all over the world, and I learn songs from different people, and then I come home and bring them back home, and they say, hey, take this song from Austria and bring it home, and sing it to your people from us, and people are like, oh, get one from the Bushmen. I'm like, okay, yeah, good idea. And forget it. You know, there's like all this counter singing going on, and it sounds like if you listen with your wide angle vision, your wide angle hearing, like peripheral hearing, it's like a chorus of crickets, right? But when you try to zoom in on any one part of it and try to get the pattern of one woman singing, she's changing constantly, right? So it's this really weird phenomenon of what feels like this total chaotic thing going on, like sacred geometry. Everybody's just sort of in this really intuitive, relaxed style. And when you listen to the song as a holism, you can recognize it as the giraffe song, right? But you can't figure out what the giraffe song actually is. And there isn't one of us who could sing it. You see what it requires? It requires people to get into a transcendent artistic and musical space together, which seems to generate that trance field much quicker. When they start going into that space, it takes them maybe 15, 20 minutes of doing that. You can even see they look bored almost when they're doing it, right? But all of a sudden, it just hits this feeling, and you get this feeling of electricity going down your back, like your hair stands up, and you feel these shivers down your spine. And just the moment that happens, everybody feels it simultaneously. Every time that happens, there's this bolt of electricity that hits the old healer, and he starts to shake. And as soon as he starts to shake, he starts to look up and talk to his mother in his language. And then he begins healing with his hands. And when he puts his hands on you, it feels like someone's running electricity through his hands into your body. That, I believe, is what's going on here also. When you're all gathering with a common purpose, calling in the rains for the time of year and the season that we're in, this particular festival that you're celebrating, these are old remnant things that really aren't just, I don't even know how to explain it. Let's just put it this way. These are actual instruction things about how to be a human in relationship with spirit and nature in a real way. You know, and there's people who are doing that still right now while we're sitting here, and they're aware that it's real, and they're aware of their feedback that they're getting through this, you know. And it's what postmodern humans have lost and sort of relegate to superstition or all kinds of stuff. But this phenomenology is totally predictable, and I've seen it in so many cultures in so many parts of the world, and I've been there with these people who still do this stuff, you know. You know, so I think you guys are doing something really important, very interesting, and to me a little bit, like I'm watching. You know, I'm watching like, okay, where is this going to go, and how are the people around you all going to react to what you're all doing? And you know, because a lot of people don't really believe in this stuff anymore. You know, but this is real sacred magic that you guys are involved with. It's very beautiful and very important. And I think that the future of the earth depends on mass numbers of people rediscovering this right now. You know, so I think it's also really important. You know, so I stand behind you, and I'm at your service as an engineer, architect, and collector of trading cards of all these different phenomenologies that create powerful prayer, ritual, and connection to Earth. So.
I just want to draw out a few things that I heard that seem really important, and one of them is that there seems to be a relationship between connection to place and being vibrant people who have abilities like this. And I'm also hearing something about what this term you use, a trance and trance state, and it kind of brings us to our next question, which is about the Jewish people in particular carry a lot of trauma and story of trauma of their people, the most recent perhaps being the Holocaust, but it definitely goes back much further than that. And I know I probably speak for most people in this room, if not everyone, that we're all interested in healing and healing the traumas, not necessarily having to carry the burden on through generation after generation. And we're wondering if you have any tips or ideas. But another hard question here. You've already started touching into it, but the real question is, how do we do that as a village? How do we do that? Do you have any technologies for the individual person on that journey and healing what we would call the ancestral or ancestral traumas and working with them? But how do we do it as a village?
And I want to add one layer to that. I'm hoping to simplify it a little bit. But we were on a phone call with some people a couple months ago where this conversation was being had about ancestral grief. And I asked you this question, and one of the answers you gave me was, it begins with nature connection. And it's, I think, one of the important messages I want to share today, and I've learned it from you, so I want you to share it, is about the power of nature connection and the role it plays in the village and in the grief healing.
Another easy question, Ralph. Okay, so nature connection, you know, it's what you're born for. It's what you're born to do. Every baby is born with a full understanding of how to do that, and the adults in the life of that baby model disconnection. And so that baby slowly but surely dumbs down until it joins the mainstream normalized disconnective experience of postmodernism, you know. And it's a real sad thing to me. You know, it really, like, if I get too into it, I get really sad. Because I always see children born with this extraordinary potential, just totally connected to nature. Born that way. Of course they're born that way. It only makes sense if you really think about it. They're born that way. What happens? And why do we disconnect? And, I don't need to go into all the things that have happened in the modern world. The way even children come into the world anymore is so disconnected. You know, talk about looking at a watch. Think about everything that happens when a baby enters the world now in hospitals and so on. And, you know, so I just want you to think, first of all, that nature connection is what you're born for, because the reason I say that, it's not a philosophical statement, it's an ergonomic statement. Okay, I'm not, like, claiming something because I have, like, a religious or spiritual belief in this. I'm just saying, basically, you need water to drink because you're a human being. Human beings need water, right? You can agree with that? You need food, right, or you'll die. We can fast and pray for so many days, but then we can't live like that. We need food. You agree?
Yes.
Good food makes you feel better than bad food, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so nature is like that for you. I mean, that's the thing that all the science is now proving, and Richard Louv has done an amazing job actually gathering all the research and putting it into one book called The Nature Principle. And you should just read it. In fact, go onto his website, the Children and Nature Network website. You ain't seen nothing yet. You know, we are, it's like all the scientific evidence basically says what Richard Louv now calls vitamin N. You know, that we need nature the way we need water and food. And we are designed to absorb our relationship to nature in a very particular way. And when you do, you optimize your system. And what does an optimized system look like? An optimized system looks like Hanuma, I think. You know? Really, I think so. And I think when I study cultures from different parts of the world, and I look for commonalities, especially peacetime commonalities. I'm I'm less interested in the warfare aspects that are common, but I'm very interested in peacetime, especially the things that bring cultures back into peace and healing. And, you know, one of the things that I see again and again is that the cultural elders are never worried about everybody becoming a Hanuma. They're always worried about a certain percentage in every generation. And that percentage is like 1%. But if you have 1% people with that connective ability, then they are sort of mixed in like homeopathy throughout the rest of the village, and they inspire the young people. And the young people see them for who they are. They see them as these ultra-connected beings who have this total relationship with creation that's just really undeniable, mind-blowing, beautiful, loving, you know. And they are always the strongest healers. They're always the strongest healers. And people might also kind of be afraid of them because people get superstitious and they become fearful of these people. But in the end, they always go to them for advice and healing. And often, you know, those people have to live on the edge of the village, right? They end up living on the little hill in the forest because they can't be around everyday people because everyday people are too loud and coarse and judgmental and full of negativity. So they have this sort of edge existence. The role of the village, when those people say it's time to have this festival or this ceremony, they call the village together. They need the people to show up to create the electricity because they can't do it alone. It's like a feedback mechanism. They need, the whole thing creates an ecology of electricity that then regenerates, for instance, one of my favorite stories from this elder who passed on in 2007, who Rachel also knew, Gilbert Walking Bull, he used to say, my people, we have these people, they call them Wachasha Wakan, which means a person who's really connected. It's pretty much direct translation. Wachasha man or Wian woman, Wakan means with ropes. Okay, with the ropes intact, basically, like no egg, right? You know, what is the egg? The egg to me is a root-bound pot, plant. You know, you go to Home Depot and you're like, hey, I want to get that plant for my garden. You bring it home, you pull it out of the pot, and there's all these white roots that are all wrapped around in the shape of the pot. That's what your egg is. You know, it's like you were a child and you wanted your connections to go out, but the people around you kept chopping them off. And so you started to wrap them around instead because you felt safer by wrapping yourself with your energy instead of letting it go out. It was unsafe to connect, you know. And when you lose your place, when you lose your relationship to land, that's a major egg force. You know, that creates major egg behavior. Like, Richard Louv, I was down in San Diego with him just 10 days ago, for the grassroots gathering of the Children and Nature Network. Were any of you there, just out of curiosity, because there was hundreds and hundreds of people there. They're talking about barriers to nature connection. And they're talking about the fact that science now backs up that nature connection is really important, but it also proves out that society is not ready to embrace what it's really saying. There's all these embedded beliefs about nature connection that prevent people from actually going all the way. And he basically was up on the stage with the microphone talking about a scientific study that identifies when somebody is cut from their place. You know, an example, I mean, obviously, you know, all the things that happened within the history that Zelik was just telling me about in the barn, starting whenever that was, the Romans destroying the temple and so on. I mean, if you just go back to that history, I mean, that's huge, okay, and you know that already, but take one individual. One individual who grows up, like Emma, right? Yeah. And she grows up and she falls in love with a little peach tree over here in the backyard, and then she starts crawling around the creek bed, and then she plays on this little hillside over here, and she befriends all the squirrels and animals, and nobody knows she's doing that. She's on her little Hanuma journey, you know? She reaches a certain age, and then all of a sudden that hillside gets bulldozed and made into a development. So they now have a name for that, the kind of shock and trauma that goes on the spirit of that person who has that experience. And it causes them never to trust again, and they won't allow connection to occur. So they'll only build relationships with nature to the point where they start to feel empathetic with it, and then they'll stop it. Then instead of the threads going this way, they go that way. And the egg is strengthened, you see? Right, so that's not—it's not an easy one to heal. You know, you're looking at somebody who had that experience. And when I was 19, the place where I was going since I was 10 got bulldozed and turned into a neighborhood, and that was one of the most traumatic things I've ever experienced. But in the recent years, I was given a healing ceremony to address that particular illness in me, because it's an illness in me that makes me not want to connect, right? Because, you know, if you love somebody really a lot and then you lose that person, then you don't really trust relationships again. You know that feeling? So that's what we're talking about, you know, and it's like a cultural phenomenon, and everyone just sort of takes it for granted and then calls it normal, you know, because we all share it together. We settle for it and accept it as normal. So there's a certain level of connection we're going to allow to happen, and then we're going to cut it off subconsciously, like a big group think. You know, and that's, to me, that defines postmodern behavior in a lot of ways, which is why the Earth is really being destroyed. All the natural resources are being destroyed the way they are, because people don't connect to the level where they feel what they're doing anymore. So they're not aware of their role in creating more and more devastation of the natural resources that hold us. But, you know, go back to Gilbert for a second and go back to this time and this place. You know, he said, there was a time, he said, when my people took it upon themselves, you know, Wachasha will come, we all will come, they just took it upon themselves, because they come over a hill one time when they're walking in the wild places, he said, and they look out over the land, and they see that the grass is withering too early in the spring. Right? The rains haven't come, the grass is withering, and they see that the mother buffalo, she's having a hard time generating enough milk for her calf. You know, he said, so those people knew what that meant, and they took it upon themselves to hold certain ceremonies, and they would call the village together, and they would use that electricity from the people. Even if the people didn't believe it was possible, all they had to do was get to the groove, you know. So as far as most of the people were concerned, they're just dancing, you know. But they get the energy to a certain place, then those Weon Wachasha Wakan could connect the energy and then ask the rains to come and send electricity into the ground and rejuvenate the grasses. And he said, nobody among my people know this anymore. And he said, they're not doing it anymore, you know. So, you know, it's not just, you know, our challenge in this particular group here in this room. This is common all over. Even indigenous people are forgetting this stuff, you know. But, you know, as far as healing that trauma is concerned, it's, you know, it requires, first of all, recognizing that there is such a thing. And then searching inside yourself to see if you have it. And the safer thing to do is to say, I probably do. How much concrete did I put over it so I can't see it anymore? You know, because we're really good at building walls inside of our consciousness to protect us from these old traumas. You know, we get really good at it. And so just recognizing that may be true is the first thing. And then the second thing is, you know, willingly, openly calling on, you know, whatever, you know, however you want to define your relationship with the Creator, with the Spirit, calling on that and humbling yourself and asking for that help in that kind of context is really what brings it on. And then having practitioners who understand what that means, and then helping, they help to really move it through. I think you guys are mostly in the East Bay, and you have one right in your midst who's actually done that very ceremony right in this barn, and I was here for that. Who knows who I'm talking about? Sibonfu Sumay. She still holds the old grieving rituals, and she understands this severing of connection, and she understands how to bring it back. And I'm sure she'd be more than happy to work with some of you to create some kind of a ritual that you could experiment with. But in a way, you guys are opening Pandora's box when you ask this question. It's a huge thing you're asking, you know. And it is, to me, the most important thing on planet Earth right now, because there's 8 billion people. I bet you 7.5 billion of them are experiencing this trauma we're talking about. I think the key to really having peace in the world and bringing our cultures back and getting everything to be connected again is to first acknowledge that and heal that. And that's going to stop war, first of all. You know, because war rages because people don't heal those things, you know. And it creates these isolated consciousness islands where people then have these ideologies that are at odds with each other, and they forgot their common root. But the common root isn't accessible anymore because we've cut ourselves off from it, you know. So, and these are all huge questions that you're asking, and the United Nations has pinned down this historic trauma thing as one of the most important things of our time. You know, they bring in Hawaiian Ho'oponopono healers to deal with it, because they still have understanding of how to heal this stuff. So.
Thank you, John. So we've gathered here on Green Oaks Creek Farm to connect with one of our ancient rituals, one of our ancient festivals. And the context of this festival is inside of an annual cyclical Hebrew calendar that connects us to the agricultural season and brings the community together. So for Passover, we celebrate the first harvest of the barley in the springtime. It's also known as the time of liberation or birth of the people. And in the summertime, you know, around June, kind of shifts with the moon cycle, but it's somewhere in that, right before the real heat of the summer, we do the Shavuot gathering, where we celebrate and honor the first cutting of the wheat. And it's mythically known as the time of receiving Torah. It was like the birth in the spring and when we're given our original instructions, you know, in the summertime. And then we gather now in the fall for Sukkot, when we're in the ingathering time, ingathering of the people, ingathering of the harvest. And most specifically, when we do the rain work, when we went to our temple and we gathered water from the well and we poured it on the stone. And at the end of this festival, we beat the willows on the ground and did circle dances and prayed for the rains. And it's fascinating that all the biblically mandated holidays are in the dry season, in this six-month period without rain. Something to it, right?
Sure are, don't worry.
And I just want to name that inside of our tradition we have these this cycle that I think is very communally is doing John what you're talking about, but I feel like in this modern age those holidays became very indoor oriented. They became very much about, you know, Passover became about sitting on the dinner table and looking at a book and telling the tale. And the Shavuot became about studying all night. We literally do it. It's called the Tikkun Leil Shavuot, which is the rough translation is, you know, staying up all night and studying from the Torah. That's actually what we do. It's not a translation, but that's what we do. And for Sukkot, you know, you build a little rickety hut in your backyard and you have dinner out there. That's you know, and there's a lot of beauty to that. But I want to. We have a cultural anthropologist and an indigenously oriented cultural healer amongst us. And one of the reasons I brought you, John, is because I want to ask you to give us your perspective on what we've been given as a cultural heritage, as what one of my rebbes would call an operating system for our culture, and the importance of the operating system. Because I think I can stand up and tell people, hey, this is really important, this is why. But having someone look in from the outside... I don't want to make you an outsider here, but I think you are looking in from the outside in a certain respect, even though I call you, you know, teacher, uncle, and also brother, and I consider you family. I also, you're standing on the outside in this way. I'd love for you to give us an understanding from where you sit on what the importance of this, so we can go home and perhaps begin to remember what we were given. Because I think ultimately that's what Wilderness Torah is all about in my mind. I think you might be able to help us. And before I hand the microphone to John, this one, there's a lot of, there's some tension in the room. Because we're working with some heavy stuff. So I want to just, this is Rachel's suggestion, just putting a bug in my ear. Just take a breath. Probably should do that again. One more time. All right, I think they're ready. Thank you. Yeah, this topic always brings up tension. This is the last one, especially healing historic trauma and separation from place. What would happen if people reconnected in a really authentic way back with nature and then did these harvest ceremonies that you're talking about from the place that we were just describing? What do you think would happen?
It would be a lot of fun.
What else would it be?
It would be connected for sure. Powerful.
A big change.
It would rain, kind of on demand, you know. It would rain when you needed it. Yeah, it would definitely transform our understanding, meaning our relationship with nature would be transformed. It would be very healing for everybody. And it would be very healing for nature. And that might be, to me, the more important thing, ultimately, because the ecosystems can only sustain so much before they give out, you know. And a lot of people who are conservation biologists and ecologists who are looking at all the trends and all the lines that are going, and they're just like, this is not, doesn't look good, you know. What are we going to do? And I think the answer is going to be that people are going to figure this stuff out again just in time, like a Star Wars film. And we're going to bring it back. We're going to bring back in a modern way what has to be brought back so that we can reconnect and take our place. You know, do you know the studies from Secret Life of Plants, the book? You know, they, if you send love to a plant, it definitely has been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt to flourish more. You know that, right?
Yeah.
If you send love to a child, they grow up, you know, and if a child doesn't get love, they grow up differently, you know, and you know that. That's all been proven, right? What happens when there's 1,000 people who are all really connected to place and send love to a place, you know? And to me, that's what these old festivals and ceremonies are, you know, and they are very, very similar across culture. From one group of people to the next, to the next, to the next, they all bear the same basic patterns. You know, there's spring festivals, there's midsummer stuff, and there's fall stuff, and wintertime when it's rainy or cold, it's the time when everyone goes inward and shares story and, you know, passes down traditions that can be taught inside because you can't get outside as much. It's very common, that pattern. And, you know, why would all humans have that pattern if it isn't speaking to something, you know, really important? I mean, you find it on every continent. Every single kind of human being has this in their history. So if I look at back to that man, Hanuman, I think about him, and then these old women in Namibia, there was four in their 90s that all were doing the ceremony together. There was, they'd all start trancing, all four of these old women, with 40 or 50 people singing. And when those four ladies got going, boy, holy. And, you know, so you're just looking at this old pattern, and you just look back at it, and it's like some recognition of our ancestral sort of design. You know, I call it original design. It's like this hand is designed to grab. I'm holding this microphone because my hand is designed to grab. The microphone was therefore designed to meet the hand, right? But I can do this because of my design. And what are the other aspects of our design that we're not actually using? You know, that we've let go vestigial, that we just don't use anymore, and some of it has to do with all of our connection stuff. And if you get back your connection, here, I'll translate something from an old song. It basically says, the people who are really connected to nature in a humble way, so that all of their wiring is reconnected back to the place, those people have really powerful prayers. And that's what the song translates out of the old Lakota language into English. You know, it's basically an instruction manual. It says, hey, if you want to have powerful spiritual ceremonial leaders that can regenerate the earth, they need to be really connected. So every generation, make sure you connect enough people. Not all of them necessarily, but enough. And those people, when they put their spirit behind a prayer, power is going to come. And it's going to really help, and everything is going to be made new. Those promises are in all these old songs and all these old ceremonies, you know? So, and I know those words are probably in yours, I would guess. I mean, I'd be surprised if they weren't, because it's like a promise, you know. It's a promise because our bodies are like this. They were given to us. They're vessels. They were made a certain way for a certain reason. There's a promise in that vessel. If it's used in a certain way, you're going to get certain results. And I think that's ultimately what's behind these ceremonies. You know, you're rejuvenating the earth each and every year. One other common thing I heard, you know, from the old holy man before he passed. He said, you know, when you're praying for the natural world, when you're praying for the natural world to rejuvenate, he says, don't just think about next spring. You know, so right now it's 2013. When you put your prayers out and your intentions, you pray for the return of the rains in the spring so that the grasses can come up, he said, in 2014. So right now we're praying for 2014. He says, but don't forget 2015. He says, so always pray for 2014 and then pray for 2015. So he would tell me that every year in the fall, we would be praying for the next spring and then the spring after that. So there's people that are out there in this, you know, indigenous way, taking responsibility for the well-being of nature, you know, 2 years out. And I think that these festivals are tied to that old behavior, you know. It's just what happened when we lost our connection to the land. We lost our understanding that that's what we were doing. But what if you guys brought that back? You know, I mean, just ask that question, just imagine it. I've seen it happening in different parts of the world where people are actually recognizing this, reconnecting to place, healing their lost connections, and having extraordinary results from that. And so I know this works, and I know it's worth it.
And one thing John taught me, he didn't say today, is also that when we're thinking about these things and we're doing this cultural repair work, we're doing it with the, you know, with 200 years from now in mind. So that the work we do today, just like in Pirkei Avot, it says, it's not up to you to finish the work, but it's also not permitted for you to refrain from beginning the work. And I know that I won't see the results of this work in my lifetime, but I'm in no small part because of this guy and others like him who've taught me. I'm here to do this work, and I feel that I'm doing it with everyone in this room, and I'm grateful. And I want to answer one thing that John said, because he said, like, I'm sure you have this in your tradition also. And then in the Torah, there's a place where it gives us a series of sacred laws. Moshe is receiving the sacred laws on Mount Sinai, and there's a whole bunch of them. You know, we call them the mitzvot, the commandments, or the what I've been told is the same root commandment is connection. So these things that we're told to do are also just ways of connecting, like in the Lakota language, wakan. It's like the ropes, mitzvah, wakan. There's something there. But then it says that if you follow these sacred laws that I hand to you, there will be rain. And there'll be grass for your cattle to eat, and there'll be rain for your grapes to grow, so you can make the wine that you use to celebrate the creation. But if you don't follow these, then your skies will turn to bronze, and your ground like iron, your sky will turn to iron, and your ground like bronze, and there'll be no rain. And we're in a time when I think we're looking at that consequence square in the face, and that it's time to step up to the sacred laws that we've been handed down, and I think the festivals are a way in, and that's why we started there. And so I hope that John's words gave some light on the importance of these things that we're doing. And so soon we're gonna go out now to our tribes, and we're gonna gather to hang out some more. And
say one more thing before you
go. Great, fantastic. And we'll get ready to do our water ritual tonight. And I want us to not think of the water ritual as a skit, you know, or is it just an opportunity to do something fun. But I want us to act as if what we're doing really matters. Granted, the rains came already. But I asked John about that. I said, okay, the rains came, so we don't need the water ritual, right? And he said, no, you need the water ritual. You need to, at least now, you make that connection even stronger by giving thanks for the rain now. It's a water-honoring ritual. So we honor that which was given to us. So when we separate, I want to make sure we do that with our heart really connected. It doesn't mean we don't have fun, because this is Zman Simchatenu. It's the season of our joy. And it's Simcha Beit HaShoeva. It's the joy at the Shoeva, at this place of water drawing. So it's fun. But it's fun with that heart connected with the intention really in that direction. So we're going to give John the final word. And then when he's done, we're going to give thanks to him. And then we're going to What's that? I'm being told by my boss that we have some time for questions. So I'm going to give John the mic to say a word, and then we're going to have a couple questions.
So I've been studying what it looks like when people are connected. You know, how can you tell? Because you can tell when they know algebra because they passed the algebra test, presumably, right? But how do you know if they're connected? Because if what we're doing is aiming for reconnection, then how do we know what connection looks like? How do we measure it? Because you want to know how to measure it if you're going to actually go and try and do it, right? So there's what Uncle Gilbert, the elder I was telling you about earlier, he had been given something from his grandfather, which was basically the metrics of connection. You know, it was called seven sacred attributes, otherwise known as Wok Pei Shakomi Wakan, which just means seven sacred attributes. And he basically said that number one, people are happy, they're joyous. Number two, they're full of electricity and they're vital. Number three, they're really committed to listening and being in presence for each other. So they're committed to mentoring, if you will. You know, they really make space to listen to each other's stories and really sit deeply with them. And number four, they're empathetic and they feel love in that way, with connection with nature. And number five, they are really helpful without being asked. They know what needs to be done and they just do it without being told. So there's no need for like bosses. There's just sort of like a oneness that occurs, and people all just show up at the right place at the right time and make things happen. Number six, they're really fully alive. They're really alive. And that means they understand the value of life. And it's not like vitality like this, the second one I told you about, but this one is about, I know the preciousness of life because it's going to end. And so I really am here with everything I have so I can fully experience this life. And the next one is love and concern for humanity, forgiveness, forgiving heart. So this last one is a unifier that pulls all the others together. It's kind of the doorway into the other seven I just named, and it's having a quiet mind and having a peace of mind. People take meditation classes to get to that, or they buy a lot of Eckhart Tolle products. But I like to point out that this whole thing started because we talked about a rabbi who could speak to the birds. And this listening with your deepest quietness inside allows you to communicate with the birds. It allows you to hear and understand what they're saying. And that's a real thing. That's a real phenomenon. I'm going all over the world now teaching bird language, and it's basically simple. Birds talk to each other. You can understand it, and it's really fun. You know, it's not rocket science. It's just that when a lion is moving on the Kalahari, everybody knows because the birds tell them, so that it keeps them safe. So those are we call them the attributes of deep nature connection, and they're important ones to recognize. And so the first one was joy, and I keep hearing you guys talk about that. The way in which you achieve connection is different from the way you achieve transfer of information. So I would, you know, teach you about a technical skill, or I would teach you a subject differently than I would work with you to connect you, right? Connection is this process. Education is that process. And a very common blind spot for modern people is that they think connection is going to happen through education. But it doesn't happen that way. They're very different. And you can have them happen simultaneously, and that's when education is fun. Remember the teachers that were really connective? And their class was really fun to go to. Didn't you learn a ton from them? So they're not at odds with each other. They're actually really a beautiful companionship. They dance together very well. But sometimes in the modern world, we think education is everything, and that one process, information transfer, is the only one we've got. But all these ceremonies you guys are doing, this festival, is a giant connection system. And joy is really big. You know, gratitude is really important. You know, all ceremonies start with gratitude, and just feeling gratitude with all those connected places would be really powerful. And hey, you got a little bit of rain today. It's very early in the season. I live here, so I know this is really unusual to have this rain. And I also know that we usually get 50 to 60 inches of rain in Bonny Doon, which is just up the hill. And last year we only got 39. And so we all living up there were really worried about forest fires this year, you know, so bring it on. But don't overdo it, because then it floods. So you got to watch Colorado. Watch Colorado, just learn from that. And ask for rain to come. Gilbert used to say, he said, you guys really have to learn how to pray for rain. He said, just don't pray for rain, you could make a flood. He said, so pray for those gentle soaking rains. And that's the kind of rain we had last night and all day. Just that gentle soaking rain. It was constant, it was generous, but it wasn't pouring down like it was in Colorado. So remember, please, you're in my neighborhood. Gentle soaking rain.
Great. We have time for a few questions, and I'm seeing some hands. So I'm going to start with Yuval back here. Can you stand up and just belt your question out with a good, strong voice?
John, what you're talking about is something that is really happening in a system called the world of education. It's something that started about 100 years ago. And it started with one school, and now there's thousands of schools around the world. And they do exactly what you're describing. But it's still a very marginal system. It's way on the fringe of human society. How do you think we can get this to public schools all over the world?
Oh.
So Yuval is asking, how do we get this type of connection into public schools throughout the world?
Yeah, take all the teachers and all the administrators and heal them from historic trauma. And get them all to go outside. I mean, that's really part of what's going on. You know, there's this repeating cycle. School was it's a model that was not designed for connection. It's not its purpose. So really just looking at, that's a huge question. I think basically it's going to require some massive culture shift, some best-selling authors, you know, all saying the same thing, and a lot of policymakers adopting it and saying yes, and then about 100 years of hard work. It's probably what we're looking at, right? So I'm not being hopeless about that, but you know, the man who told me, hey, this work is beginning to catch on, we should see the results in about 200 years. He told me that in 1992. So we don't have that much longer to wait, but you know, it just gives you a sense, you know, that what we're doing is really, we're building a foundation right now for our culture to restore itself, as opposed to actually moving into a complete house, right? So we're the ones who are clearing the site for our foundation. So this is a lot. This is a lot. And every little way we can do it, I mean, it's each of you has some influence. So just my suggestion always around this question is, let's start with ourselves. Let's get those attributes I just described. Bring them back for you, because, you know, selfishly be happy and joyous and connected, right? Start there and then influence your family. And it'll make your children much happier if you aim for connection. Your kids will be really grateful for that, and then your neighbors, and, you know, that's where it's going to really start. And if you're a teacher, then you become one of those connected teachers. If you're an administrator, be a connected administrator, because connection spreads through modeling, not through ideology. Right? Remember that. Connection spreads through modeling, not ideology. Okay?
And I also want to point to Wilderness Towards Kids programs, B'chutz and B'nature, offering alternative forms of connective experiences for our youth, which we're learning from some of our teachers here. Do you have a question?
So one facet of Jewish festival and Jewish tradition is that especially I'm thinking of at the end of Passover when we say, and next year in Jerusalem, and this 2,000-year ache for the loss of Israel and the 2,000 years of diaspora. And, of course, there's all of the other cultural trauma, you know, from pogroms to Holocaust. But, at the end of Passover, we don't say, and may we be, may we have release from those cultural traumas. It's this ache for the land. And, you know, I'm a San Francisco native. I live in San Francisco, so I have a profound rootedness here to the California coast. But it comes up in my spiritual practice, this question of this 2,000-year heritage of land ache that is in some ways particular to us because we still remember it. And so I was wondering if you would speak to that.
What's the specific question that I'm speaking to?
In terms of talking about cultural repair, it's this prayer that we, and maybe other people in the room could speak to it more clearly, but it's this ache towards being back in the land, that all of this intact cultural phenomenon that we're experiencing here comes from. When we talk about doing Passover in the desert and receiving Torah, there's a specific desert. It's not like the desert, and you know, and all of the old writings, they are land based. They're not like the idea of land based, but they are land based to particular river valleys and particular deserts, and that's infused in all different parts of our tradition.
And there's so much that needs to be done to repair it. And
yes.
I think that a lot of us have had that journey, and I've personally had a lot of trouble being there because of the state that it's in.
Mm.
So can you help us to figure out?
So I wanna give John a heads up right now that what's being asked of you right now is a very difficult and charged question, and that the politics of Israel and the historical trauma around Israel runs very deep, and it's very divisive in our community. And in a wilderness story, while we don't take a position on Israel at all, we totally acknowledge that it's our homeland, and it's a huge question. So I want to offer this way of framing the question, because I think we all feel this and experience this. How do we as Jews, living in the diaspora here in California or other places from which we've come, do this connection when, you know, our indigenous root is in that place of Israel? And what does it mean to be here when our indigenous root is there? And, you know, and maybe you could speak of that from a pan-indigenous cultural perspective.
Yeah. Okay. I'll talk about it from what, you know, Gilbert Walking Bull used to say to all of us. He said, you know, you guys worry that you're not native of this land. He said, but you were born here. Or you're living here now and you've decided to be here. He said, so you are. You know, it's a choice that you make, he said. You know, and he literally means literally a choice. So am I going to let my root go down or not is the question he's asking, right? Because he said, you're here, take responsibility for this place, he says. You know, and, you know, he said, because look, my people, they won't take responsibility anymore. You know, they've fallen into modern ways, and they've lost their own connection, he said. But I have to say to you, this earth needs us to take responsibility. He said, so are you here or not? He said, you're born here. Where else are you from? You know, and he was, you know, he's not tracing it genetically. He's tracing it spiritually in that, you know, that egg sense that I was describing earlier. You know, like, are you going to allow your electricity to flow down into this earth where you're standing or not? Is the question he was posing to us. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, and that, to me, that's like that transcends culture, ideology, religion, and it basically says humans need to love their pets. Right? Humans need to love their children. Humans need to love the soil that they're standing on. It's all the same. But we have things in our mind that prevent us from actually realizing, okay, well, it's not. I'm not native to this place, so I can't really do that. And you know, that was what Gilbert was constantly challenging. So that's one perspective, and I feel that that's true because I am absolutely clear that there's electrical phenomenon around us, and that when we allow ourselves to love and intend into a place, things change in that place because of it. You know, that's just true. You know. And he said to us, I have to tell this story because I think this will really kind of put the exclamation point on this. He said, you know, you guys, I've watched you guys are all activists, he said. All you do is stand around with signs, save Mother Earth, he said, but all you do is piss everyone off, he said. And he said, and so they don't like you anymore, and he said, you create more tension in your community, and he said, you're not helping the Earth in that way. He said, you're not going to help the Earth that way. He says, I think I know more about helping Mother Earth than you do. And he says, I'll show you. He says, I went down into the trout office here in Duval, Washington, which is Western Cascades Bioregion Foothills, so the Western Cascades. I walk into this office here, a trout office. He said, I'm curious about this trout office. So I go in, I find these guys, and they're nice enough fellows. They care about trout and salmon, he said, and these fish are gone. He said, what? He said, but I live, I told these men, I live up on this Cherry Creek up here, you know, up in Duval, up here in these hills. Tell me about the salmon and the trout in my creek. And they told me, oh, that Cherry Creek, he said, that's that run of salmon is extinct now, 11 years, 12 years, there hasn't been a salmon run there. So that genetic stock, he said, is gone. And I said, I shook my head. He said, that I know they care, he says, but they're so misguided. And we're all looking at him like, what are you talking about? Misguided. You know, these guys are federally funded, you know, they got hatcheries, they're clearing, you know, they're having, you know, community days where we all go and walk in the creek and pull out trash and make sure the trees are growing and shading the water. I mean, they're doing all the right physical things, right? But the salmon are gone, he said. And then he starts laughing. He says, I'll show you. He said, they're not gone. He said, that's their idea, they're gone. They're not gone at all. He said, you watch. He said, I'll do one ceremony and those fish will come back. So he did. He did one ceremony, and we waited. The fish didn't come back. The rainy season came, and at the end of the rainy season, on the far end, when the snow was still falling and the rain was falling, there was a man who was there who was crying at his sit spot because that salmon run was extinct. And his sit spot was on the creek. And that next spring, where there was snow on the ground, and it was raining, and he saw all these salmon coming up the stream. And he just walked in the stream with these salmon and he just cried and laughed. Because he was there when Gilbert did that ceremony. And he suddenly understood what Gilbert was saying. There's a technology that we've lost, or a belief structure we have that prevents us from actually taking responsibility for our land. And when Gilbert heard that the salmon came back, he just shook his head and he laughed. You know, he just said, I told you. He said, now you guys learn to do that because that's what I mean. You take responsibility for your place. It isn't just physical, it's also spiritual. But if you have an idea that you're really from somewhere else, then you won't allow yourself to be here. And that's kind of just a deepening of that statement. But, so you're probably wondering, did anyone try that? So a bunch of hapless people that I know, ragtag bunch of us, did everything he told us. And we had a massive steelhead run that year in the San Gregorio Creek. And we had 8 pairs of them on one stretch of creek. We saw that with our own eyes. And he said, make sure, though, that you don't call them in when the land or the forest is not ready to take them back. So you don't want to ask them to come back and then don't do the physical. You have to do the physical work and the spiritual work, not just the physical work. Yeah. And not just the spiritual work. You need both, okay? But the spiritual work requires a commitment to be connected to the place you're at. So that's number one. Number two, those ceremonies that come from those places transfer to where you are now, because in the ceremonies themselves are the teachings of how to be in this relationship that I'm describing right now. Those ceremonies are instruction manuals as well as ceremonies that regenerate electricity on the spot. They're both. The songs that are there, the prayers that are there, they are all giving you the recipe book about how to reconnect your people. They're not historical records, they're operating manuals. You know, they're operating manuals. It still works. My understanding is that a lot of the stuff that's in Old Testament can't be said in the past tense. Is that right? You can only say it in the present tense. But when you translate it into English, a lot of people will translate this stuff and say, you know, back then, right? It happened back then, but it's happening right now. If you look at it from that perspective, suddenly all of those religious teachings become operators' manuals instead of archaisms. You know, it's live teachings of how to be in relationship with Creator now and creation now. So I think that's important to know. And there's nothing wrong with honoring where you come from and remembering that, because you'll nourish from going back there. But then if you're committed to living here, this is where you are. You know, so that's pretty much how I'll answer that.
So I think we're about nice swing. So we're about at time, but we have a practice here at Wilderness Torah where we use a Hebrew word. We tend to translate them. And John used a word from his language that I want you to translate for us. And it's actually two words. Sitzvah. And if you wouldn't mind briefly sharing sitzvah, and this is a connection that Rachel and I had come up with, which is, you know, we Jews are largely urban people. Not completely, but by and large, urban people. And this nature connection thing, you know, how do you do that when you're in the city? Maybe a tough question, but the broader question is, what is a sitzvah and why is that important? And if you can keep it somewhat brief, because I know you can spend an hour on this topic, but then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah. You said the word too.
What's that?
Sitzvah, yeah, okay. There's a company in Boulder Creek called Sitzvah, and they teach dogs obedience. But that's a short definition. But that's not what I'm talking about. So a sitzvah or a sit, you know, a place to go in nature that you go to and you just connect. Basically, it's a place to practice connection. You know, and my sitzvah at home is my front porch, and there's a bench there. And I just go out just under the eaves so the rain can fall and I can still sit there. It's just a place where I go several times a day and I just sit. Why? Well, just so I can connect with my senses and I can see my friends who live there. There's chickens that walk around and there's little cats that walk around. And then there's juncos that yell at the cats when they walk around. And there's scrub jays and Steller's jays and squirrels. And there's deer that sneak in at night and try to eat our plants. And they succeed usually. You know, so a sitzvah is just a place where you go to build relationships with your other than human neighbors in the plant world, the animal world, where you watch the moon and the sun and the stars, you know, and you try to get to know it all times a day, all times a year. You build a relationship with it. And maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes at a time if that's all you got. You can do it in the city. You can do it anywhere. And it's kind of like 24-hour fitness for your nature connection. You know? If you jog, you know, get cardiovascular, and you go to the gym, you know, to keep your muscles toned, and if you do all that kind of stuff, and you do yoga to keep everything limber, then your sit spot is in that same category. It's just a way to make sure that you're getting your connection system operating. So it's a good thing to do. It's common to all people around the world in different forms, but it's necessary. When you were a child, you might have had one, a favorite tree that you used to hang out in when your sister got mad at you. And you just go there to just unwind and to just build relationship. I watch my daughter. She sings at her sit spot. You know, I'd love to just get like plant a little bug there and just record her because she says the sweetest things when she's there. She doesn't even know she's doing it. I think she's just in this sort of semi-catatonic state. But it's very beautiful and sweet. And when you see it happening, you know it's right. And it's this relationship that's building between her and place. And you can see it happening. So that's what a sit spot is in a nutshell. I hope that helps.
Thank you. There was an 18th century master rebbe named Reb Nachman of Bratslav, the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov they mentioned earlier. Great grandson, thank you. My rebbe here, making sure that I don't misstep. Great. And he would send his students out into nature and to do what was called heat bodadut, which was making yourself alone in nature. And this is a core practice. And so I'm going to hand the microphone now over to my Rebbe here, Reb Bert Jacobson, who's been studying this tradition in a very deep way for a very long time, to offer brief word and maybe a summary thought on what we've been talking about here. It would be my honor if you'd like to do that. Great.
What we're talking about, I think, is the Garden of Eden. That story, which comes in the second and third chapters of Genesis, is about expulsion from the earth. As a punishment for having eaten from that tree in the middle of the garden. We could look at that story a different way, though. As a description of humanity alienated from the earth. And the writers wanted to give a Jewish moral perspective on that, so it's the serpent that persuades Eve, all that baloney. But what it's describing is the fundamental breakage that happens at a certain point in human civilization. And our task is to get back to the garden. That should be the purpose of the Torah. It means reconnecting. And this is partly what the Baal Shem Tov taught. It means reconnecting with our instincts, reconnecting with what's natural within our lives and with our connections with the earth, and seeing that as a holy way to reconnect with our mother. And we can call her the Shekhinah, for she dwells within. She dwells within the natural world and within us. Rabbi Lin over there wrote a book called She Who Dwells Within. It touches on all of these issues. Very powerful book. I don't know if it's still in print.
It better be.
So, the way we compose this as Jews and using our own mythology is, how do we get back to the garden?
I think we give a nice offering of gratitude to John and Red Burt and all of you for being here.